Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Thank you for choosing our podcast. Our sponsors make it possible for us to keep bringing you new episodes. Please support them as they have some great deals just for you, our listeners. If you prefer to listen to ad-free content, simply find us on Patreon, where plans start from as little as $2 a month. 25% of these proceeds are donated to the Doe Network, working to bring closure to international cold cases. For more information, follow the link in the show notes. Today's episode is brought to you by Noom, helping people around the world enjoy healthier lives through better nutrition and exercise. You don't have to change it all in one day. Small steps make big progress. Sign up for your trial today at noom.com/evidence locker. Our cases deal with true crimes and real people. Some parts are graphic in nature, and listener discretion is advised. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. In August 1980, the police were dispatched to an apartment in eastern Helsinki, Finland, following a report of a woman who had accidentally died in her own home. At the door, the investigators were greeted by the woman's 37-year-old husband, Ismo Juni, who without words simply pointed in the direction of a walk-in closet. As the officers stepped in, they discovered the half-naked body of a 36-year-old, Kaya, partially wrapped in a wool carpet. She had injuries on her head and one missing tooth. But nothing at the scene directly revealed what had happened. There was no way for the investigators to know that they were looking at the very first victim of one of Finland's few serial killers. Ismo and Kaya Juni lived in an apartment in Kontula, Helsinki, with their three children. Theirs was a tumultuous household, with both Ismo and Kaya being heavy drinkers. In the 80s, Kontula was also not the most desirable neighborhood, notorious for the prevalence of drugs and violence. This is not the case anymore, but back then, it was a bit different. Police often received calls reporting incidents of drunken fights and even domestic violence. So when they arrived at the Juni home on that August day in 1980 to find Kaya deceased, they had their suspicions that her husband Ismo had caused her harm. However, there was not enough physical evidence to charge him, and they had no immediate reason to arrest him. While investigators waited for the results of Kaya Juni's autopsy, Ismo and the couple's three young children were questioned. The children, who were all under 15 years old, remained mostly silent or replied to the questions with one or two words. Ismo, however, explained to the officers his and Kaya's marriage had not been the happiest. They mainly spent time together drinking alcohol and fighting, so much so that the neighbors were well aware of the Juni's marital problems. Based on the interviews alone, the police had a reason to doubt Ismo's version of the events, claiming Kaya had died because of falling while intoxicated. And the findings made by the medical examiner only strengthened the suspicion. According to the autopsy report, Kaya's healthy upper incisor had been knocked out before her death. Otherwise, the only visible injuries were bruises here and there. The likely reason for Kaya's death was found as her brain was examined. She had suffered extensive intracranial hemorrhage as a result of some kind of blow to the head. Following the autopsy, Eastman was arrested, but he maintained he had nothing to do with his wife's death. After all, he and Kaya were both known to drink a lot, and people fall over all the time when drunk. In the end, the investigators had to admit that the crime scene and Kaya's injuries matched accidental death, no matter how suspicious they felt about Eastman. As there was no evidence of his involvement, the investigation was eventually closed and the case archived. For a long time, Kaya Uni's death was considered an unfortunate accident, until one phone call changed everything and ended up revealing much more than anyone could have ever imagined. In 1990, emergency services were contacted by a young man who asked the police to reinvestigate a death that happened 10 years earlier. The caller was the eldest son of Eastman and Kaya Uni, who he will call Auntie, as his real name has not been made public. Auntie explained to the police that his mother's case a decade earlier was closed without proper investigation, and the police's conclusion was not even close to what really happened that day. It was not just that Auntie suspected his father was involved in his mother's death, but apparently he had seen the whole thing. Auntie shocked the officers by telling them that he had witnessed his father kick his mother on the head. As a result, the investigation was reopened, and Eastman was brought in again for questioning. Eastman recounted the events of that fateful evening, initially maintaining a story about Kaya falling in the bathroom and hitting her head on the edge of the bathtub. According to Eastman, he and Kaya had been spending the evening the same way as many evenings before, drinking. At some point, an argument broke out simply because Eastman didn't like that Kaya was drinking the wine straight from the bottle. Soon, insults turned into a physical fight that was heard by the neighbors. Kaya was hit, kicked, and thrown toward the furniture, and eventually injured her head badly on a sink or edge of a cabinet, just not accidentally. Eastman admitted that he then carried Kaya to the bathtub, which he filled with hot water. During the autopsy, the medical examiner found water inside Kaya's lungs, so she was still alive at this point, and submerging her in the water had played a part in her death. Eastman also told the investigators he had taken one of his wife's teeth as a memento that he kept inside his wallet. Eastman had used an electrician's tongs to remove the upper incisor while Kaya was still breathing but unresponsive. He said he did this to check if she was still alive. When she didn't react, he thought she was dead. He called the police, but by the time they arrived, it was too late for anyone to help her.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Following Eastman's confession, the police obviously began to suspect him of murder. The neighbors also told the investigators that Eastman had been heard to threaten Kaya's life many times before. But to strengthen their case, the police continued to look for evidence and wanted to speak with one person specifically who was known to be close with Eastman at the time of the murder, a man named Matti Hapanen. Matti had been Eastman's good friend and neighbor, and the police believed he might have crucial information regarding Kaya's death. But as the investigators tried to get in contact with him, they found out he and his dog had died in the fire of the summer home in 1986 in Kivinoka, Helsinki. Matti's widow, who was described as a sharp-sighted and precise woman, told the police that her husband's death still bothered her, not just because of Matti's horrifying fate, but because Eastman's behavior after the incident made her feel uneasy. According to Matti's widow, her late husband's friend had told her he had been present at the time of the fire, which made no sense at all. When the police then began to look into Matti's death, they soon discovered a plethora of strange incidents connected to Eastman Uni. Kivinoka was, and still is, a popular place for people to spend their summers in their allotments. Oddly, there had been an extraordinary number of cabin and warehouse fires during the 1980s, during which Eastmo's friend Monty and three others died. The police discovered that Eastmo had strong connections to the area. His parents had owned a summer cabin there that was later sold. Kivinoko was a place where Eastmo felt at home, and so even though he didn't have his own summer home, he spent a lot of time there with Monty and other acquaintances. The deeper they dug, the more investigators felt something was not right, and so they asked for permission to open the investigation into the death of Matti Hapanen. The permission was quickly given, even though it came with a message saying something along the lines of, "Investigate as much as you want, but this was an accidental fire." Nevertheless, the detectives on the case immediately sat down again with Eastmo and asked him about the fire. At first, Eastmo told the detectives that he had seen Matti on the day of the fire in November 1986, but he was nowhere near Kivinoka that night at the time of the incident. However, as the detectives kept questioning Eastmo day after day, his story changed. Each time, Eastmo placed himself a bit closer to the fire until finally admitting it was him who had burned down his friend's summer house. According to Eastmo, he and Matti had gone to Matti's cabin to spend the evening and drink alcohol, as they often did. At some point, an argument broke out. He couldn't recall what it was about and dismissed it, saying the reason was silly. The two men began wrestling. Eventually, things spiraled out of control, and Eastmo hit Matti on the head with a plate and then again with a heavy glass vase. As a result, Matti's partial denture broke, and so did his own teeth. One of his upper incisors came through the upper lip, and it was that tooth Eastmo pulled out with his bare hands and put in his pocket. During the fight, a candle had fallen over, but instead of putting out the fire, Eastmo ensured it spread across the cabin. Satisfied with his work, Eastmo picked up a burning lacquer jar and a bottle of alcohol and walked out, leaving Matti unconscious on the bed. Eastmo then proceeded to throw the jar into the neighboring cabin's wall before finding his way to a nearby stone wall where he could sit and watch the fires. Eastmo's confession was a huge breakthrough, but the police needed to confirm if he was really telling the truth. And so, they went through the original case files looking at the details that may have originally been thought to be caused by accident, but matched Eastmo's version of the events. One of those details was the fact that the neighboring cabin's wall had burned very badly. The initial investigation concluded that the heat of the fire in Matti's summer home was enough to set another home on fire. However, Eastmo's confession about the lacquer jar made much more sense. In addition, Eastmo had this rather strange but remarkable ability to recall insignificant details. During questioning, Eastmo was able to tell the investigators precisely about the interior of the cabin. He even drew a detailed layout on paper. He also remembered such things as what the color of the oven mitt was, what fabric the drapes were made of, and what kind of vase he used to hit Matti. The police then compared Eastmo's account to old photographs they had acquired of the cabin. It was quickly confirmed Eastmo was indeed telling the truth. Next, the investigators read through Matti's autopsy report. The fact that he had a blood alcohol level of 0.2 again fitted Eastmo's version of events. Disturbingly, the police also confirmed that Matti had still been alive when the fire broke out. His lungs showed signs of smoke inhalation. Furthermore, Eastmo had told the investigators that when he walked out of the cabin door, he heard his friend calling out in agony. At this point, the police had already reopened two cases that were initially considered accidents. Now the question was Eastmo responsible for the rest of the fires? There had not just been strange cabin fires in Kivinoka in the 1980s, but somebody had also set fires to outhouses and garbage cans, pretty much wherever they could. If there was a connection between all the incidents, it would mean that the police had not just an arsonist on their hands, but a serial killer. When the police looked into the fatal fires in the area, they found a case that took place just a few months before Matti's death in July 1986. Two men had died in another cabin fire in very similar circumstances. When the investigators then asked Eastmo about the fire, it didn't take long for him to admit he was indeed responsible for the deaths of Seppo Montaniemi and Juhavari, and began explaining what had happened. Eastmo said, "Well, I wasn't asked if they could have a drink, but they just took the bottle without asking, so we fought." According to Eastmo, he had met Seppo and Juha while they were fishing near Kivinoka. The three men had drinks together and eventually headed to a cabin to continue drinking, but as Eastmo said, things eventually took a turn for the worse. What started as an argument escalated to a full-on fight which resulted in Ismo being kicked out of the cabin. He then walked to the stone wall where he sat for some time. But instead of calming down, Ismo felt more and more angry and resentful, and eventually decided to return to the cabin. At this point, Seppo and Yuha had already fallen asleep and didn't wake up when Ismo quietly entered the summer home again. He then picked up a candle and dropped it between the two men on the bed. As the fire began to spread on the sheets, Ismo walked out and poured lamp oil under the cabin. It took only a few moments before the fire was totally out of control. Seppo and Yuha never had a chance to get out on time. Meanwhile, Ismo stood a short distance away, watching how the cabin and the two men inside it burned to the ground. Once again, the investigators asked Ismo to describe the interiors of the summer house and requested pictures from the relatives of the two men to confirm the story. Straight away, as they were checking the photographs from the crime scene, the investigators noticed a bottle of lamp oil next to what was left of the cabin. In addition, Ismo was able to recall accurately what Seppo and Yuha looked like, especially their body types. Ismo explained to the police that he had basically measured the physiques of the two men. He said he had thought the younger man was quite slim and would not cause trouble during a fight, but the older one had big fists and strong-looking arms. So even though Ismo claimed the argument had started over drinking etiquette, he had known from the beginning what he was about to do. Ismo's interrogations continued for weeks, and not that surprisingly, his mental state began to deteriorate. One day, Ismo requested a meeting with his priest, and that wish was granted. Meanwhile, the investigation continued, and the police reopened another odd cabin fire case, this time from 1988. The investigators learned that everyone who spent time in Kivinoka knew a man named Pauli Sirinen, who was often seen in the area with his bicycle. One day, in November of 1988, Pauli's cabin burned down with him inside of it, and just like all the other fires, the case was quickly closed and marked as a tragic accident. But when the investigators mentioned the third fatal fire in Kivinoka and asked if Ismo had something to do with it, he immediately said, "Well, yes." Apparently, Ismo had been buying liquor in Hirtoniemi when he accidentally stepped on the toes of a man standing in line behind him. The man in question was Pauli Sirinen, who didn't mind his foot, but instead made friends with Ismo. The two men headed to Pauli's cabin together, and just like in the other cases, drank and had fun until a fight ensued over some unknown, probably trivial reason. As a result, Ismo was once again thrown out, and instead of just letting go, he waited somewhere hidden for the right moment to return to the cabin. Pauli was either sleeping or passed out after drinking too much, and didn't wake up when Ismo walked back in and picked up a bottle of lamp oil. He then poured most of the oil on the cabin floor and lit it on fire before going out and throwing the rest of the oil on the wooden stairs. Again, Ismo stayed there watching how the fire developed and only left when emergency services arrived at the scene.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
At this point, the investigators were astounded. What had begun with a phone call about the suspicious death of a mother 10 years ago had become an investigation into the murders of 5 people. After months of putting pieces together, the case went to the municipal court in Helsinki, where every single detail was gone through again. Ismo didn't have anything to say about the crimes he had already admitted. That was until the very last fire, the one that killed Pauli Sirinen. All of a sudden, after a very long legal proceeding, Ismo recanted his confession. He told the court that he could not have been present at the time of the crime, as he was being treated for alcoholism in a facility located 50 kilometers from Helsinki. In the blink of an eye, the case everybody thought was going to be open and shut was put on hold until further investigation had been conducted. The police replaced the officer who was responsible for interviewing Ismo to ensure he told the same version of the events to everyone. This detective also went and questioned employees at the detoxification center and checked their records of the patients. It was quickly learned that even though Ismo may have been treated for alcoholism in the facility, there was no way to confirm if he was present on the night of the murder. The facility's patients were not exactly forced to stay in the building, and due to the number of patients being close to 100, nobody would have ever noticed if one of them had snuck out or were absent. On top of that, during the second round of questioning, Ismo himself admitted he could leave the facility whenever he wanted, and only had to put something in his bed so it appeared as if he were sleeping there, in case a night guard was checking. In the end, there was no difference in the stories Ismo told to the two detectives, as he mentioned details of Polly's cabin that he could not know in any other way than actually visiting the summer home. This time, Ismo even told the detectives that he had tried to take Polly's bicycle, but couldn't break the chain lock. That bicycle can be seen on the crime scene photos with sheet metal shears next to it. There was no question whether Ismo had been present on the night of the fire or not. It took 2 years altogether before the court reached a verdict in February 1992. Ismo Yuni was eventually found guilty of the murder of Seppo Montanimi, Juha Vare, Matti Hapanen, and Pauli Saarinen. In the case of his wife Kaija, Ismo was initially convicted of an act according to the Finnish criminal law that is equivalent to manslaughter. But the Helsinki Court of Appeal changed the conviction to aggravated assault and negligent homicide. Furthermore, Ismo was found guilty of arson and destruction of property. One of the detectives in the case later mentioned Ismo was even found guilty of destroying trees in the city area. For all these counts, Ismo Yuni was sentenced to life imprisonment. In Finland, the law does not specify a maximum or minimum term for life imprisonment, but on average, this sentence lasts 14 years. After 12 years, the Helsinki Court of Appeal will automatically deal with the continuation of life imprisonment or decide on the prisoner's release. However, in Ismo's case, that would never happen. After his conviction, he served just 3 years of his sentence before he died at the age of 51 in 1995 due to complications following heart surgery, taking answers to many unanswered questions to his grave. During the investigation, Ismo's motives for his crimes were never fully revealed. Investigators, however, speculated that this was Ismo's way of showing superiority and proving he was capable of such things. According to Matti's wife, after killing Kaija, Ismo began to threaten people regularly and said he would take revenge on anyone who had done him harm. Ismo seemed like a person who was jealous of what others had and easily expressed his discontent in a violent way. During the investigation, Ismo underwent a mental examination, which concluded he held a grudge even after minor incidents with others. Even if a person said one word wrong to him, Ismo remembered it and waited for his moment to strike back. That explains why he refused to leave after an argument with his drinking buddies, and instead sat there waiting before burning their cabins down as an act of revenge. It's also believed Ismo felt resentment because he had spent many happy summers in Kivinoka at his parents' summer home, but the cabin was eventually sold to a stranger, making Ismo suddenly feel like an outsider in the place he loved most. In the end, Ismo was said to have shown some signs of remorse after the whole process was over, but it was clear he had been proud of his acts at the time. He had taken the teeth of his victims as souvenirs and stood there watching the fires. But as he only ever spoke about the crimes that he was asked about and never opened up about his motives, many details of what drove Ismo to kill were left in the dark. Also, almost nothing has been said publicly about Ismo's upbringing, his childhood, besides the summers in Kivinoka, and the years leading to his marriage with Kaija. However, Matti Hapanen's wife, Ayla, gave an interview to a Finnish magazine focused on crimes called Alibi in May of 1992, and revealed the events leading to Ismo's wife's and her husband's death from her point of view. According to Ayla, Ismo and Matti met during one of their drunken trips. The two men eventually became friends and their families began hanging out together. After the sudden death of Matti and Isla's baby girl due to meningitis, which led to blood poisoning, Matti drowned his sorrow by drinking continually for a year. As Isla didn't allow alcohol in their home, Matti spent a lot of time at Ismo's house. As a result, Kaija, who didn't even like drinking, began to get drunk just so she could stand her husband's behavior. Isla explained the situation by saying, "Matti could stay there for days, even weeks. Sometimes men come to us just to get pissed as I didn't tolerate drunkenness in our house. Ismo was jealous as hell. He suspected that Kaya was sleeping with other men. Sometimes Ismo drank too much and needed to go to sleep first, so Kaya stayed to keep Mati and other friends company. When he woke up, Ismo didn't know what had happened while he was sleeping and began to suspect the worst, so his wife got a beating just to be sure. I think Mati and Kaya got along very well. They were somehow on the same wavelength. I was a little jealous of this myself at first. However, I soon realized that I can't do anything if two people like each other. Ayla continued by saying that she and Kaya often spoke about how they should swap out husbands. Ismo tried to force Kaya under his command, but she refused to keep her mouth shut and bowed to her husband. Meanwhile, Ayla didn't mind a man being the head of the family, and she didn't drink, just how Ismo liked it. When Mati then managed to stay sober for a long time, Ismo also tried to quit drinking and go to work, but with poor results. According to Ayla, Ismo's life was nothing but trying. He always started something but never finished. But there was one thing Ayla was afraid Ismo would eventually carry through to the end. For some time, Ayla saw the signs of Kaya's life being in danger. But unfortunately, in their residential area in Kontula, Helsinki, it was a norm that no one contacted the authorities but tried to manage everything on their own. If the police started asking questions, nobody would know anything. Ayla tried to talk about the situation to Mati and her mother, but both ignored her worries, saying that nothing could be done about these things anyway. Then came that one day in August 1980, when Ismo walked into Ayla and Mati's apartment looking unusually neat, with a fresh shave and combed hair. As Ismo stood there in his clean pants and pressed shirt, he calmly stated, "Kaya is dead." According to Ayla, Ismo told them that he was sure the police would try to blame him for his wife's death. But after police questioned him, Ismo returned home happy, explaining that the investigators had tried to put the murder on him, but they had nothing to prove it. Ismo then proceeded to tell Ayla and Mati how Kaya had fallen on the stairs before having a bath. She was drunk at the time and had accidentally fallen into the bathtub, causing her to drown. After the death was ruled an accident, Ismo received life insurance and pension money of 50,000 marks, equivalent to about 27,000 euros or dollars today. Together with Mati, Ismo used that money to buy copious amounts of alcohol. Strangely, when Ismo was drunk, he told many different versions of Kaya's death to his friends. Eventually, Mati and Ayla became suspicious and wondered if it really was Ismo who had killed Kaya, and just then, he admitted to pushing his wife's head under the water. During her interview, Ayla claimed she spoke about Ismo's confession with her husband many times, saying she wanted to go to the police, but Mati refused. And so, for years, nobody else, except Ismo's children, knew what really had happened to Kaya Uni. Afterward, life carried on as normal. Ismo and Mati continued drinking and having wrestling matches. But Ayla noticed that at some point, Ismo stopped fighting and let Mati smack and mock him, calling him the bathtub man. Ismo only calmly replied that in the end, they would see what would happen to Mati. And to Ayla, Ismo said, "Don't worry, it will soon be easier for you, too." That remark made Ayla think, as she explained in the interview. "Afterwards, I have thought about Ismo's words many times and came to the conclusion that Ismo had decided to kill Mati and was just waiting for an opportunity. He wanted to get rid of the witness, and secondly, he wanted to make my life easier." In addition, Ismo, in his drunken state, sometimes spoke about his eldest son because the boy had told his father he knew the truth about his mother's death. Mati even once saved the boy's life. One day, Ismo had hit his son's head against the concrete wall and would have killed the boy if Mati hadn't intervened. Around this time, Ismo's father made the decision to sell their cabin in Kivinoka, making his son very bitter. However, as Mati and Ayla then bought a summer home in the area, Ismo still had a place to go. In July 1986, the first cabin burned down, killing Juha Vari and Seppo Mantinimi. According to Ayla, she believed the fire was just an accident, but Mati immediately thought Ismo had something to do with the incident. That, however, didn't save him, as on November 25, 1986, the second cabin burned down with Mati inside of it. Now, Ayla had no questions about Ismo's guilt, and eventually she told the investigators everything she knew. And yet, Isla's statement was brushed off as insignificant, and she was basically ridiculed because everybody thought the fire was just an accident. Ayla described the following years by saying, "After the death of Kaya and Mati, Ismo became anxious. I too lived with anxiety for more than 5 years. I knew Ismo had killed his wife and my husband, so I ran away with my thoughts to work. I spent more than 4 years in two jobs. Working days were constantly stretched to 16 hours. I felt immense relief when the investigations were restarted in January 1990. In court, Ismo's eldest son said he would doff the hat to me because I had the truth. It is shocking that most of the crimes of Ismo Yuni would likely have gone unrevealed if it wasn't for his own son. Without that one phone call, one of Finland's worst serial killers and arsonists' crimes could have been only remembered as tragic drunken accidents. And who knows how many more cabins he would have burned down.
We'd like to thank today's sponsors, Noom. Sign up for your trial today at noom.com/evidence locker. That is Noom, noom.com/evidence locker.
If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. Also, visit us on social media to see more about today's case. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also check out our channel on YouTube. If you like what we do here at Evidence Locker, subscribe in Apple Podcast or wherever you are listening right now, and kindly leave a 5-star review. This was the Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.
Has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hey there, True Crime Podcast fans. It's Patrick and Jillian from True Crime Obsessed.
Each week on TCO, we recap a true crime documentary everyone's talking about, and we do it with heart, sass, and just the right amount of humor.
So if you like the kind of podcast where two good friends chat about a case in a thoughtful way that centers the victims, you really got to check us out.
Yeah, we cover the well-known cases that you hear about in the news and the underreported cases that desperately need more attention.
For almost 9 years, we've been one of the most popular true crime podcasts out there.
We have over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, and our brand new YouTube channel has over 50,000 subscribers watching our full-length video episodes too.
So find and subscribe True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.